Siete organization. And that developed out of a situation where a group of Latino activists, young Latino activists, seven of them, were being framed for the murder of a couple of police officers. And an organization developed that was originally basically just the Los Siete defense campaign, but then developed into a wider organization to serve the impoverished and oppressed Latino community in a neighborhood called the Mission District in San Francisco. And they established ties with the Red Guard Party and with the Black Panthers in Oakland. And this was definitely conceived of as internationalism because, again, the framework, the ideological framework that these people were adopting at this time, the young activists were adopting at this time, was based on a firm rejection of the idea that their communities were minorities in American society, that they were American minorities, Mexican Americans or what have you, and based on an understanding of their communities as nations, as colonized, oppressed nations within the United States. It was slightly different with the Asian American communities, who had a somewhat different historical experience in terms of immigration, but in general, they all saw themselves as being intimately connected to the surge of third world national liberation struggles and of having a deep, deep commonality of interest in overturning white supremacist capitalism in the United States. And the American Indian movement also developed in the same time yeah. among initially young Native Americans in the cities in the Midwest, but also spreading across the country. And their ideology was had a different, to some extent, a different set of influences, influenced by sort of a revival of indigenous traditionalism in a lot of ways. But they also did echo the third world internationalist ideology of the Black that was being put forward by the Black Panthers and these other organizations to an extent. So again, there are variations dealing with the specific histories and deriving from the specific histories of all of these oppressed people, but ultimately they were united by a common framework that the Panthers had developed and popularized. And that might not seem so remarkable. It is, but it might not seem that way given that all of these groups of people suffer from racial oppression in North American society. But then there was another set of organizations that was influenced by the Black Panther Party that, as you said, many people are surprised to learn ever existed because they were organizations made up of white people. And I've already mentioned one group of white people that was influenced by the Black Panther Party, and that was Students for a Democratic Society. But Students for a Democratic Society had a particular demographics, a particular social character, in that it was made up of university students, and it was made up in the majority of young white people from middle class backgrounds. Working class people were going to university in the United States in larger numbers than they ever had before at this time, but at least the founders and the people who set the character of SDS were mostly middle class people. But towards the end of the 1960s, some young white activists who were from working class backgrounds began to wonder if they wouldn't be able to organize in their own communities. And this was also a demand that was being put to them by the black movement. Mm-hmm. Not so much specifically by the Black Panther Party, although the Black Panther Party did play a role in it. But one important development that happened in the late 1960s was that the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which had been the main organization of black youth in the United States in the early 1960s, took a nationalist turn. People like Stokely Carmichael became more and more influenced by African nationalism, by Pan-Africanism. And a decision was made that white activists would no longer be allowed to work in the organization. And they were told to go organize their own people. And most of the white activists who were involved, some of them were, you know, they were hurt, but they accepted the political rationale. They accepted, you know, the fact that they needed to take direction from the black movement on this. And they did start to take up the task of organizing their communities. Of course, one of the features of this situation is that the situation in North America in the late 1960s is that there's a real climate of militancy and mass mobilization among people of color, especially the black community, but not just the black community, in all these other oppressed nationality communities that we've been talking about. But there was much less of that going on among the broad majority of white Americans outside of the campus environment. But there was a very significant effort made to change that. And so you have organizations sprouting up in white working class communities in Brooklyn, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, in Boston, in Vancouver. There was an organization in Vancouver that tried to carry out the politics of the Black Panther style sort of community organizing. It was called the Partisan Party. And some of these organizations, it's funny, they had names that you would not imagine a leftist organization having. There was an organization in Brooklyn called White Lightning, which sounds like a racist organization, but it was a militant anti-racist organization that was taking up this task of organizing white people. And that meant two things. That meant attempting to convince poor and working-class white Americans that they should support the Black Liberation Movement. But it also meant organizing these communities around their own needs. And there were particular situations that were sort of very, very close in some ways to the situation that had produced the Black Panther Party. In the 1940s and 50s and 60s, there was a huge migration of poor white people from Appalachia into the industrial sort of Northwest and Great Lakes area. And they ended up concentrated together in communities with high unemployment and low incomes and terrible housing, and young people in those communities were dealing with police harassment as well. So there was an organization that developed in this Appalachian community in Chicago called the Young Patriots. Again, Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton was able to create an alliance between the Black Panthers, the Young Patriots, the Young Lords. I believe there may have been a Chinese organization in Chicago involved as well, mm-hmm. a Chinese-American organization. And this was called the Rainbow Coalition, which, of course, would be sort of the name 20 or so years later, adopted by the Jesse Jackson campaign in a very, very different set of political circumstances. But this was the first Rainbow Coalition, and it's probably the clearest example of the internal internationalism, you could say, of the Black Panther Party. And I think Fred Hampton expressed this most articulately and most clearly, but it came from all the major leaders of the Black Panther Party, was that they really deeply believed that they were not simply participating in and dealing with a struggle of black people against racist oppression. What they were dealing with was a struggle of all oppressed and colonized nations and all oppressed and exploited people in North America, in the United States, in North America, and in the world against a system defined by racism but also by capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so they believe that even if at first, you know, many white workers were hesitant or poor white people were hesitant to support the Black Liberation Movement, that ultimately this alliance could be created because all oppressed and exploited people had common interests. And that's also one of the crucial contributions that the Black Panther Party made.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is something we are definitely not told about. I mean, the idea that the white supporters of the Black Panther Party, who actually made a real effort.
Yeah.
Like organizing effort in their own communities to organize effectively white people against the very colonial structure, racist colonial structure that had, you know, supposedly empowered them, but at the same time, you know, supposedly elevated them over African Americans and like indigenous people and this sort of thing, but basically were also using them and exploiting them and basically treating them as, you know, weapons to be used, tools, mm-hmm. you know, basically being used and turning them almost into little monsters, which they effectively were refusing to be a part of, which is pretty profound. I think that has lessons for us right now.
Absolutely.
You know? But thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about this, because I mean this conversation has been amazing.
It's my pleasure.
You know, your insight into this, you brought a lot of knowledge here, And I'm amazed you managed to remember all that. I mean, that was... I mean, you can't see this. People are actually listening in, but Brendan is sitting here. He has no notes in front of him. He's basically just, you know, you did a lot of preparation, obviously.
I tried.
But at the same time, like, you're, you know, this is all coming from your head, right? This is just communicating, which is absolutely amazing. So once again, comrade, I want to thank you again for contributing here on this show.
Thanks a lot.
It's great
to
this here.
Always great to be here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to take a short break here. I'm back in the USSR, and we're going to be back after a few minutes, so please stay tuned.
Yeah. 1, 2, 1, 2. Flow combat, B, I born that, beaches storm that, reformat the masses, I'm redrafting the battle map, set top of task list, I build a classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit, I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts, packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes, I make fascists, craft in pantsers, stanzas, cure culture. Cancer. I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum, getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis, my word act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed, punch, crash the fun by metric tons and plus my math, distribute cash among the classes, take from the grieving greedy bastard, get back like church hats or get past, collapse structure, fuck facades, I destruct the support beams and bars, wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction, flip the shit just like a brick throne, dethrone kings, bring the trees on, my tone rock like Gibraltar pop, hip hop hotter than a rocket shot, I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big talk, teach you to flee from the flock, walk off, switch shit, hit my target, drop like bombs in the form of carpets, I got the target locked on now, oh shit. Pump your fist if you know what we on. That's a rap. Boom bap. Original rap at. Take it to back. Boom bap. Boom bap. I'm talking true path, master the craft, the pupil, the prof, keep dropping math. Boom bap, blast the bazooka rap.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, your community station.
The Guelph Little Theatre is excited to present Kenneth Cameron's Saving Sleeping Beauty, taking place every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday from November 24th to December 10th. When an angry fairy condemns the baby Princess Rosalind to die on her 16th birthday, her parents beg Cerulean the witch to save the child. Cerulean's answer is not what they hoped for, putting the girl to sleep for 100 years. But the witch knows that keeping Rosalind alive is only the first step towards saving Sleeping Beauty. This is a fun new family musical by the GLT's own Kenneth Cameron. Tickets are $15 for adults and $12 for children 12 and under. Come on out to Saving Sleeping Beauty from November 24th to December 10th at 7:30 p.m. on Fridays and 2 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. The Guelph Little Theatre is located at 176 Morris Street and is a physically accessible location. Visit GuelphLittleTheatre.com for more info and to purchase tickets.
Aerobics. Gonna stretch your mind.
Your life.
Tuesday morning, your life. 7 to 9, CFRU 93.3.
Work it out.
Girls Rock Camp Guelph is back March 12th to the 16th, 2018. This unique experience provides female-identifying youth the opportunity to create a band, write music, learn how to play instruments, and perform it all live in 1 week of training. The outcome of the camp is more than just music. The campers feel empowered to be who they are, to be creative, and to bond and share that experience with their new friends. Applications and more information for this year's camp are available on our Girls Rock Camp Guelph Facebook page or email us at girlsrockguelph@gmail.com. Applications are due February 25th, 2018. Girls Rock Camp is physically accessible. Chill.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, and it's true that one of the things I haven't really talked about too much in quite a while, of course, is Palestine. And as many of you will know, Palestine has basically rocketed back into the headlines with regard to the United States, basically Donald Trump and the United States recognizing the settler colonial state of Israel and its effective annexation of the entirety of Jerusalem. And now it looks like the American embassy will be moved to Jerusalem. And this, of course, is against the will of the entire international community. It is a slap in the face for the self-determination of the Palestinian people. And they are fighting back. They are resisting. And needless to say, they are not letting this go unanswered. They are the resistance is very strong. And now, this is something I definitely want to devote an entire show towards, the struggle in Palestine right now. I won't actually be here next week, but the week after that, I most likely will devote that show to Palestine. But tonight, I want to play a interview that was done on the Real News Network just this past week. Which deals with the current struggle, the new phase of struggle now that the U.S. has decided to move its embassy to Jerusalem, and how this changes the ground in terms of like how the Palestinians fight for liberation. So I'm going to play that right now. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's The Real News. I'm Aaron Mate. The uproar continues over President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. At least one Palestinian has been killed and dozens have been wounded as Israeli forces crack down on protests across the occupied territories. Protests are also being held around the world, and the UN Security Council has held an emergency session. Joining me is Noor Erekat, human rights attorney and professor at George Mason University. Welcome, Noor. As you see this response, both in the territories and around the world, your thoughts today?
So two thoughts to start off with. One is that I just want to, you know, start by expressing some sort of emotional weight that Palestinians are feeling. This is an incredibly sad moment. And in addition to feeling rage and righteous rage, there's a lot of sadness and a heaviness around the fact that this announcement comes around Eid or Christmas for the Christians amongst us and really dampens the mood and the reality that we continue to live under a settler colonial reality. And what President Trump has done is to mark the inevitable consolidation of Israel's settler colonial project that is intent on the elimination of Palestinians as a people and their containment as mere Arabs, as Bedouins, as individuals, as refugees, but not as a people who are deserving of their self-determination. Palestinians have been waging the struggle for self-determination ever since 1917, when British Empire decided that it would juridically erase Palestinians as a people in order to make way for the establishment of a Jewish national home in their place. This was a colonial decision. It was a colonial erasure. And what Netanyahu has said recently in response to Trump is that Trump's announcement about Jerusalem is the equivalent of the Balfour Declaration designating all of Palestine for Jewish settlement. And so we are seeing a continuity of this colonial process that continues to erase Palestinians, but we're also seeing a continuity in U.S. foreign policy that has steadily moved forward this project by adopting a dual process of speaking out of both sides of their mouth. The United States, especially since 1967 under the Lyndon B. Johnson administration, has simultaneously told Israel and the world that there will be no resolution, that unilateral resolution imposed on the solution either by way of international law or external interference, that it will be a completely negotiated resolution. At the same time, the United States has enabled Israel to expand its settler colonial holdings over Palestinian lands without regard to putative borders or otherwise, in the form of unequivocal diplomatic aid, shielding it from any kind of international censor at the United Nations, in the form of unequivocal military aid that has made Israel the 11th most significant military power in the world, but also the only nuclear power in the Middle East, and in the form of financial aid that has ensured Israel will stay afloat and have a remarkably powerful economy on the global scale. These things together have immunized Israel from any kind of external pressure. So despite the international community insisting that there must be a solution and a just solution to the Palestinian condition, it has been able to act with impunity in order to continue its settler colonial project of erasure, to usher in an era of apartheid under the doublespeak of the United States, which has now ended as Trump has revealed, has removed the emperor's clothes to reveal U.S. foreign policy for what it is, which is as an enabler for Israel's project.
Noor, I want to talk a bit about how we got here and the key role of Democrats in laying the groundwork for Trump. After all, just recently it came out that Chuck Schumer, the head of the Democratic Party in the Senate, had urged Trump to declare Jerusalem as the unified capital of Israel. And on this front, I want to go to two clips. They're of President Obama speaking at AIPAC in 2008, and 4 years later, Chuck Schumer in 2012.
Any agreement with the Palestinian people must preserve Israel's identity as a Jewish state with secure, recognized, defensible borders. And Jerusalem will remain the capital of Israel, and it must remain undivided.
Everyone knows the vast, overwhelming majority of Democrats. Democrats have always been for Jerusalem being the unified capital of Israel. I'm one of the leading Democrats on Middle East policy. That's been my position for a long time. So this is a tempest in a teapot. The overwhelming Democratic position is just that.
So that's Chuck Schumer in 2012. Before that, Barack Obama in 2008. Noora, it's been interesting to see the Democratic reaction to Trump's decision. People have been criticizing him, but yet they're in a tough position because they effectively support the exact policy that he's carried out.
Look, this is one of those issues where there's really no daylight between Republicans and Democrats, with a few very brave exceptions on this issue. This has been a bipartisan issue. It's something that unites Congress rather than splits them, and is really, really unfortunate because it's moved Congress to act against its own American interests, as was demonstrated with Netanyahu came to address Congress in order to undermine President Obama's Iran nuclear agreement in a way where they actually showed more loyalty to what Israel needed in the region than to what the United States thought was necessary. And so this is not surprising, but I think what it should be pointed out for our audience, there we are in a moment that has been defined by resistance to Trump as if what Trump is doing is unprecedented. In some cases, it might be more bold, it might be more bombastic, irresponsible, and lacking and arrogant, but it isn't necessarily a rupture. And especially on this issue, the declaration of Jerusalem as Israel's capital is the consecration of five decades of U.S. foreign policy on this issue. This is actually the pinnacle of and an inevitable outcome of what the United States has been doing to shield Israel from any kind of international accountability. It has issued in the U.N. Security Council between 1967 and the present 43 vetoes in order to shield Israel from the application of international law that would stem its settlement enterprise and its project. It has done very little. It did nothing in order to stem the building of a wall on West Bank territory and to preserve the territorial integrity of the occupied territory. And so it is spoken up out of both sides of its mouth. On the one hand, and these are all administrations, Democratic and Republican alike, on the one hand, it said that settlements are counterproductive and that Israel must abide by the Fourth Geneva Convention. And on the other hand, indeed, it has protected Israel and shielded it so that it can continue to get away with its practices on the ground. And so lest we valorize President Obama on this issue, even when in his last, one of his last acts in office, he actually oversaw an abstention in the Security Council and the passage of UN Security Council Resolution 2334, which affirmed the illegality of settlements and affirmed the territorial integrity of the territories. At the same time, he also promised Israel more military aid than any other administration, increasing U.S. aid to Israel from $3.0 billion over 10 years to $3.8 billion over 10 years in an MOU that basically guarantees Israel $38 billion. So even in that moment of what appeared like a U.S. shifting its policy, it was still speaking out of both sides of its mouth. Responsibility for this, however, and for exposing the U.S.'s doublespeak and for pivoting us, pivoting Palestinian fate away from this disastrous U.S. course, is on the Palestinian leadership, which has had opportunities over and over and over again to shift course, to move away from the backwaters of bilateralism, to use international law, to use accountability mechanisms after repeated onslaughts on the Gaza Strip, for example, to use the opportunity that 2334 represented to us, to use the ICJ decision in order to wage a global boycott, divestment, sanctions movement in order to place sanctions on Israel. And yet the Palestinian leadership and its undue faith has clung on to the idea that the U.S. as global superpower will deliver independence to it. And that's just, there's no reason. They've had empirical evidence that devastates that possibility, and it's not justified. And so now this is another moment that is testing Palestinian leadership. And the saddest part about this moment is that Palestinians may be a part of consolidating Israel's control rather than resisting it at this juncture.
And the ICJ decision, just to clarify for people who don't know it, that's in 2004 when the World Court ruled against the Israeli separation wall that cuts throughout the West Bank, separates more Palestinian territory from each other in order to keep Israeli control of the illegal settlement blocks. Let me ask you, Nora,
really quick, just to highlight for folks who are interested in that, the ICJ decision that Israel said that Israel has the right to self-defense and every right to build a wall. It just said that it cannot build that wall in the West Bank territory and has to build it on the 1949 armistice line. The reason Israel built that wall 85% of its route into the West Bank was in a land grab scheme under the veneer of security. And so that was the issue. So let's not confuse whether or not Israel has the right to build a wall. This was specifically about why Israel's building the wall, where it's building the wall, and what pretext is it using to build it.
Right. So given the Palestinian leadership, as you say, has been ineffective and in some ways complicit in all this, in collaborating with Israel as a sort of surrogate police force inside the occupied territories, I'm wondering if you see any different signs now. We saw the top Palestinian negotiator say that the era of the peace process is over and it's time for a struggle for a one state. We saw Palestinian officials say that Vice President Mike Pence, the so-called defender of Christianity in the Middle East, tell Pence that he's no longer welcome in the birthplace of Christianity in the Middle East, Bethlehem, when he comes to visit soon. So are we seeing a change of course already from Palestinian leadership?
I hope so. That would be the right thing to do. If not now, then I don't know when. We have had repeated evidence that the United States is either unable or unwilling to change course in order to restrain its most significant ally in the Middle East and to actually act as an honest broker, and it has any interest in Palestinian freedom. What the United States has been trying to give to Palestinians is autonomy and asking us to accept getaway sovereignty in the place of meaningful freedom. Unfortunately, we have, instead of resisting that plan, insisted that if we continue to be complicit and to work with the United States and to do everything that it's asking for, that somehow the United States is going to change course and change its policy. That's why we rescinded the 2009 Goldstone report from the Human Rights Council that was to hold Israel to account for its war crimes in the Gaza Strip after the first onslaught in 2008-2009. That was why we've done very little with the ICJ decision. That's why the leadership hasn't endorsed BDS. There have been some positive signs, however, when Palestinians actually went to the ICC, notwithstanding U.S. protests. There's positive signs that the Palestinians, for example, have signed on to human rights treaties and are insisting that they are going to pursue some sort of alternative international course, as we saw that they did during the UN General Assembly when they pursued their statehood bid. That said, Palestinian leadership is also speaking out of both sides of its mouth. On the one hand, it's hedging its bets and still has faith in the United States. On the other hand, it keeps using these veiled threats and these small incremental steps that are moving away from the United States, but never fully resisting it, never fully pivoting away from it. And so it's maintaining Palestinians in this holding position. And the UN Security Council deliberations today are yet another indication of that, when the discussion went back right to square one, where they were talking about this doesn't make negotiations impossible, and that Palestinians and Israelis should still negotiate. Palestinians should negotiate, but Palestinians need negotiating leverage, and they have none when they are leaving this in the hands of the United States and not making it costly to Israel or the United States in the form of legitimacy in order to increase their negotiating leverage. And we have failed to take advantage of that. We failed to take advantage of that after the first Intifada, and this is an anniversary of it. It was the first Intifada that led us and ushered us into the peace process. And yet we relinquished and squandered that opportunity to enter into Oslo, rather than taking advantage of the international community's support for Palestinian freedom. We have grassroots support. That doesn't mean that we're necessarily going to prevail, because as we've seen, dictates of powerful states oftentimes have the last word. But it means we have a better chance that way than we do by continuing to pander to Western states that aren't necessarily invested in freedom and that have no kind of signal or urgency from Palestinian officialdom that they should change course and also punish Israel.
Noor Erekat, human rights attorney and assistant professor at George Mason University, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine. While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse of the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume, and it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly, and we are automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family. Palestine remains
is in my heart forever. We stand for peace, times of war, we shan't surrender. Remember, it didn't start in this dark December. Every coin is a bullet if you're Marks and Spencer. And when you're sipping Coca-Cola, that's another pistol in the holster of them soulless soldiers. You say you know about the Zionist lobby, but you put money in their pocket when you're buying their coffee. Talking about revolution sitting in Starbucks. The fact is, that's the type of thinking I can't trust, let alone even start to respect. Before you talk, learn the meaning of that scarf on your neck. Forget Nestle, Obama promised Israel 30 billion over the next decade. They're trigger happy and they're crazy. Think about that when you're putting Huggies nappies on your baby. Sing it with me now. Free, free Palestine. Free, free Palestine. Free, free Palestine. Not just a war over stolen land. Why do you think little boys are throwing stones at tanks? And we'll never really know how many people are dead. They drop bombs on innocent girls while they sleep in their bed. Don't get offended by facts, just try and listen. Nothing is more anti-Semitic than Zionism. So please don't bring bad vibes when you speak to me. There's plenty of rabbis that agree with me. It's your choice what you do with this message. Don't get it confused, I view this from a human perspective. How many more resolutions have to be violated? How many more children have to be annihilated? Israel is a terror state, they're terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televised, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die. Sing it with me now. Free, free Palestine. 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 Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.
I thought I'd begin by talking about all of humanity. You know, start with a small subject and then build up like that. All of humanity can be divided into three groups. Group A is made up of those people who live off their stock dividends, the interest on their bonds, their land and mineral and oil royalties, and the rents they collect. They make up less than 1% of the world's population. They live primarily off that. I mean, David Rockefeller may also get a salary at Rockefeller Brothers Association, I don't know, but that isn't how he gets rich. He gets rich from all this coming in. Group B and C are the other 99-point-something% of humanity. The people in Group B live off wages, salaries, fees, commissions, pensions. And Group C is made up of about 1 billion people of the world's population, and they live in utter desperation. They don't have wages, salaries, pensions. They live from hand to mouth. They live on scraps, and they live in hunger and utter desperate poverty. Now, what the people in Group A and B have in common is that they both live off the labor of the people in Group B, and Group C, of course. And we hear a great deal about rich nations and poor nations, but we should keep in mind that groups A, B, and C are found in all nations. You have people of A, B, and C right here in the U.S. You have them in Zaire, and you have them in Indonesia, etc. And we often refer to the juxtaposition of wealth and poverty. We often make reference to the juxtaposition. We say, there's such a great wealth here and such great poverty here. Isn't that terrible? This contrast, this gap. And what can we now do about the poverty? And then we sort of forget about the wealth. What can we do about these people? How can we help them? And what we really ought to start doing is recognizing that there's a dialectical interaction, interrelationship between these two things, that there's no accident that there's great wealth and great poverty, that great wealth creates great poverty, that wealth creates poverty. Throughout history, societies that had no great concentrations of wealth generally had no great poverty. There could be scarcities, there could be modest levels of consumption, but not the extremes we have today. There could be hunger if the crops failed, if the herds disappeared, but that hunger was shared by everybody. And there was always a place at the fireplace for everyone. Wealth, ladies and gentlemen, causes poverty. Now, that's not what the ideology of capitalism tells us. The slogans are quite different. The slogans are designed to create a false community of interest. We hear that a rising tide lifts all boats. It's class partnership, not class war. It's not zero sum. As the pie gets bigger, we all get a bigger slice of it. Well, in fact, a rising tide can sink many boats. Most of the gains that we have won have not come from a larger pie, but through democratic struggle. It is zero sum, and that is what the people in Group A are keenly aware of. You see, every dollar I have to pay to you for some stupid, annoying, unnecessary thing like wages, occupational safety, pension funds, health plans, environmental protections. Every dollar I have to pay out for those stupid things is one less dollar that goes into my pocket. And I am keenly aware of that. And if you think there's any boss, any owner, who isn't always directed by that consideration in everything he does, then you should learn something about who are the people who own and control the wealth of our society, who sit on the boards of directors of the corporations, the banks, the hospital corporations, the museums, the media cartels, and the like. Wealth causes poverty, and poverty creates wealth in that dynamic. You can't have rich plantation owners unless you have slaves who are working from dawn to dusk and even after dusk, working hard to create that wealth, consuming but a small portion of it for their own meager, miserable subsistence, so that the rest could go off to the people in the great house on the hill who live in a style of utter luxury and whatever. You can't have rich feudal lords in the manors unless you have serfs who are doing the same thing. And you can't have rich corporate conglomerates unless you have wage and salary workers who will work a whole lifetime and at the end of that lifetime not know any kind of economic security of any sort, own nothing but maybe a mortgage on their house or whatever, if that. So the secret to getting rich, ladies and gentlemen, is not to work hard but to get others to work hard for you. I've had that in one of my books, and I got a letter from a student out somewhere, I forget where, I think Midwest somewhere, who said, "Dear Professor Parenti, we are using your book, and on page 28 or something, you say, the secret to getting rich is not to work hard, but to have others work hard for you." And then he said, "I think that's very good advice. Could you tell me what would be the places where I could go where I could get people to work hard for me at very low wages so that I could get as rich as possible as soon as possible?" Snicker, snicker, you know. Wise guy. So I took his letter. It was signed Theodore something the third, right? So I wrote all across the top, I said, "Dear Teddy, some jackass sent me this letter and signed your name to it," and I mailed it back to him. And I don't think that was the answer he was expecting. But as wealth concentrates, poverty spreads. The number of people living in poverty today throughout the world is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. And wealth is concentrating in vaster, vaster conglomerates. Now, why is that happening? Why do people in some countries work for 18 cents an hour? Would you work for 18 cents an hour? No, you wouldn't. Now, why is that? Is it because you're so much more resourceful, so much smarter than the Indonesians? Is it because you have higher self-esteem than the Zairians? Why is it you wouldn't work for 18 cents an hour? Well, it's because of the level of democratic struggle where we happen to be at. If conditions got ratcheted down and grounded down, the day might come when we might be working for 18 cents an hour. The Indonesians worked that way because of the relative conditions of labor and capital, because of the relative conditions of democracy versus plutocracy, because of the relative conditions of poverty and wealth. And so what you have is this struggle. The Indonesians and the Zairians and the people in Asia and Africa and Latin America are also the victims of what I call maldevelopment in my book Against Empire. The poverty of the third world is not an original historical condition. It's not a neutral, natural historical process. They're not that poor because they just live in those warm climates and they're lazy. That's what I learned when I was a kid in school, that people in tropical climates just can't get it together. They have too many kids, they like to dance too much, and they just don't concentrate and aren't hardworking, and so that's why they're so poor. You know, they're stupid people, not like us. That's not true. I'm glad you're laughing. It's true. Okay, Walter Rodney, who was later assassinated, a Caribbean, wrote an interesting book entitled, a very interesting title, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. What's interesting about that is the use of the word underdeveloped as a verb. How Europe underdeveloped Africa. Rodney was pointing out that Africa, you know, had a level of production, consumption, civilization, that the people in Africa were quite capable of building this remarkable country that they had. Countries, I should say, sorry. In fact, when Cecil Rhodes and his cutthroats went into the ancient kingdom of Zimbabwe, which he then modestly renamed Rhodesia after himself, now renamed Zimbabwe, but at that time, they came upon architectural artifacts which they couldn't figure out how they were built. There wasn't any plaster, there wasn't any nails, and you couldn't get a slip of paper between the massive stones. How did they calculate? How did they do these things? They had no idea. They were too busy, of course, killing the native denizens of these lands and taking over their lands. And that's what happens to these people. Their lands are taken from them. Their lands are taken over and given over to commercial cash export crops, to mining and minerals. The goal of capitalism is to transfer living nature into commodities and commodities into capital. That's the constant goal, is to take nature. Nature is one of the natural resources which you then use, which is one of the sources. There are just two sources of wealth. That's nature, the land, the minerals, all these things, and the human labor power that you put into it to transform those things, to make them marketable and give them exchange value. So these societies, self-sustaining, self-employing, give way to wage labor. They give way to utter destitution. They give way to shanty towns, to disease, to underemployment. And that process went on in Africa and India. That's a process that began even in England in the late 18th century with the English peasantry of deracination, driving people off the land, de-skilling, and turning them into subsistence labor. Take the case of India. In India, in 1800, India was exporting more textiles to world markets than England was. Between 1800 and 1830, the Brits went in with their gunboats and they de-industrialized the great textile centers of Dhaka and Madras and drove those people back out onto the land to go raise the raw materials, the cotton, and put up prohibitive tariff barriers against Indian goods in England and such. And that whole relationship transferred, and the Indian textile market was destroyed. By the way, the Indian terms are still used in textile. Madras is a pattern, right? Paisley. Those are Indian things. India's debt from 1850 to 1900 grew by £53 million. The per capita income in India in that time declined by 65%, almost two-thirds. So India was being underdeveloped, you see. That's why I don't call them the underdeveloped world or the developing world. Even the developing world, which is a euphemism for underdeveloped, still implies that the original condition was poverty, and now they're these late blooming developers. They're finally developing and catching up. They were not underdeveloped. They were overexploited. Frederick Engels, Karl Marx's collaborator, who we are all taught is irrelevant and has nothing to say, he took a trip to Ireland in 1856. And Ireland now is the oldest of Britain's imperialisms, 800 years. And they're white people, they're Caucasians, Europeans. I make that point because I want to make clear that the function of imperialism is not racism. Racism is a very good rationale, and it's a very good weapon and a bludgeon to be used. When you starve people out, when you destroy their villages, when you murder their men and rape their women and spit their babies or enslave them to build the mines and all that, you have to justify that, and so you say they're moral inferiors, they're savages, they're animals and all sort of thing. But you didn't go there because they're black. You went there because their land had wealth in it, and you wanted to exploit them and use them. And you'll do that to whites. The first imperialisms were against other Europeans, Ireland and Eastern Europe. And that's how Western Europe began its first capital accumulation and colonizing. And this is what Engels says, as late as 1856 now. We've already had, by then, about 400 years of British imperialism in Ireland. Quote, "How often have the Irish started out to achieve something, and every time they have been crushed politically and industrially." Get that? Not just politically, which is always what's focused on, but industrially too. Never mentioned. "By consistent oppression," Engels goes on, "they have been artificially converted into an utterly impoverished nation." Now the key words there are artificially converted, you see. It's not that they were just naturally poor. They were artificially converted into poverty. "The poorer I can keep you, the hungrier I can keep you, the harder you will work for less. And that's when you line up for a job that's 18 cents an hour. The Mayan Indians in Guatemala, in the early 16th century, before the Europeans came, had a better diet, more calories, more protein, and better conditions of health than they do today. They had more artists. They had more musicians, more architects, more horticulturalists than they do today. They're not underdeveloped, they're overexploited. They're not underdeveloped, they're maldeveloped. And these conditions are brought about by a process of capital penetration, market domination, superior mobilization of force and violence, and then the expropriation of land and labor. People in these countries don't need to be taught how to farm. They need the land to farm and the implements and the seeds. They don't need to be taught how to fish. They need the boats and the nets and access to shore frontage and bays and oceans and someone to stop the chemical plants and oil tankers from dumping their toxics into the waters. They don't need to be convinced that they should be using hygienic standards. They need the conditions that will allow them to have clean drinking water, clean clothes and homes. They don't need nutritional advice on balanced diets from some Peace Corps volunteer from North America. They need food, and they usually know better than the North Americans what foods serve their nutritional needs. Now, U.S. intervention goes on throughout the world to make that world safe for the people in column A. This is a very hard point for many Americans to accept, that their government is not pursuing all these things all around the world out of a concern for this little people here or that little brown or black or white people, if you talk about Kosovo yourself there. That's what's really motivating us. We're humanitarian, we're concerned. We're concerned about democracy. We want to bring them elections and all that. People really think that's what's motivating people like George Bush and Bill Clinton. The United States has a global empire. It has about 300 major military bases all over the world. Its troops are stationed on just about every continent. Its planes fly over every region. Its ships sail every sea. Why? We're told we have to protect America. We have to protect it from those who might want to be coming after us and attack us. Never understand why they don't want to attack Denmark, let's say, or or Finland or something. Why America? There are people out there who might want to get us, you know. Or we have to just intervene to help all these other poor people. Well, in fact, the United States, the U.S. leaders have not been interested in propagating democracy. They have supported some of the worst fascist dictators throughout the world, in country after country. And they have, in fact, overthrown any kind of government that has tried to perform any kind of redistributive politics, that is, had tried to in any way cut a somewhat better deal for the people in column B and C as opposed to the people in column A. And when any government or any movement tries to infringe on the overweening privileges of the people in column A, that's when U.S. force comes on them. It happened in Portugal during the Colonel's Rebellion in the 1970s. Whether it be a Christian socialist government, as in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas, a social democracy coalition in Chile under Allende, which was a popular front of a diverse number of parties, democratically elected, overthrown by the CIA. In Jamaica, another social democratic coalition under Michael Manley, overthrown by the CIA. In Greece, under Papandreou in 1965, democratically elected government. The Dominican Republic under Bosch, democratically elected government. Or it could be a Marxist-Leninist government, as in Cuba, Vietnam, and North Korea. Or it could be an Islamic revolutionary order, as in Libya under Gaddafi. Or even a conservative militarist regime, as in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was CIA. He was put in by the CIA. But he wanted to cut a better deal on oil, you see. Saddam Hussein also put in very unsavory and unnecessary and ridiculous things like free health care and free education in Iraq. Those are the kind of things which indicate that you are suspect, that you are not properly dedicated to free market neoliberalism. And you then will have to be dealt with. And there were people in America, I remember students saying to me, I cannot believe that my country is bombing Iraq and killing all those people simply because of a question of oil. They're doing it because they want to rescue the Kuwaitis. I said, no, they're not. The Iraqi army is leaving Kuwait and they're still killing them. He said, I cannot believe that. I have faith in George Bush, who was president at the time. And that's a scary thing to hear it from a young person. You have faith in George Bush? I trust him. I said, you have faith in George Bush the way my Italian grandma had faith in St. Anthony? I mean, you light candles to George Bush? You say, oh, Giorgi, Madonna. Is that what you do? What do you mean you have faith? What is this religion we're dealing with here? You trust George Bush? You're not supposed to trust him. I mean, trust is something that you reserve only for very close friends and relatives and loved ones. And even them, check them out once in a while, right? The whole essence of democracy isn't trust. The essence of democracy is distrust, you see. It's accountability. It's answerability. It's exposure. It's challenge. It's debate. It's explaining yourself, please. George Bush, Jesus Christ. He would get up there and he'd say, I'm going to get Saddam Hussein. You know, that dynamic way he talked. Oh, Georgie hit me. Oh, wow. There was a very cruel feminist, a cruel, cruel feminist who once said, George Bush reminds every woman of her first husband. Which I laughed at, you know, And then I started thinking about it, and I called my ex-wife. I said, do I remind you of George Bush? She said, what are you talking about? I felt better. We all have our moments of insecurity, you know. The public record shows that the United States is the foremost interventionist power in the world. One of the reasons for intervening is to protect direct investments or to create opportunities for new investments or to take over what are potential resources that are there. In Somalia, for instance, you had 2/3 of the country was under contract because of oil reserves that had been discovered in Somalia. And that's when Bush sent troops into Somalia. You remember that? And again, we had our Boy Scout liberals, our friends saying, I can't believe he said we'd send troops in there for anything. He's going there because he said there's a famine and he's going to help them. And you have to say, helping the starving Somalians with marines and tanks and guns, and how does that feed them exactly? I mean, when did George Bush ever indicate in all his entire political career that he cared about starving Africans? There was famine in about 7 countries in Africa. Why did he go into Somalia? What about all the other places where hunger was being... You know, later on he wrote a book with Brent Scowcroft admitting that the whole war in the Gulf was about oil. He said it was about oil. It's interesting. In 1907, Woodrow Wilson, who was later to become President of the United States, he recognized the support role that the capitalist state plays on behalf of private capital global investments. Quote him, "Since trade ignores national boundaries and the manufacturer insists on having the world as a market, the flag of his nation must follow him, and the doors of the nations which are closed against him must be battered down." Isn't that interesting imagery? I mean, just come right out and they say it. "Concessions obtained by financiers must be safeguarded by ministers of state, even if the sovereignty of unwilling nations be outraged in the process. Colonies must..."